There is a natural tendency for us to try to avoid things that we find intimidating, things that are sort of scary to us. For instance, I imagine I can speak for a lot of the older folks here. Now, the young people are all into this high-tech stuff, but I'll tell you, for us older people, they start talking about some of this high-tech things, some of the things involving the computers and all of that. I'll tell you, that's way out of my league, and I'm really intimidated by that. I'm afraid of that. I stay away from that. I'll tell you another example, and maybe all of us can relate to this. Have you looked under the hood of your automobile lately? I'm telling you, well, you know, it used to be when I raised the hood and looked inside, I knew what I was looking at, and I could even work on my car and do some things. Now I raise the hood, I don't even know what I'm looking at. What are all those hoses and wires running around in there? I have a theory. It's sort of a conspiracy theory. See what you think about this. Is it possible? Is it just possible that some of those hoses and wires that are under there don't do anything at all? They're just there to scare us. They're just there so that we won't try to work on our car ourselves. Instead, we take it back to the dealership so they can charge us hundreds of dollars to do a very common repair job. I don't know. I'm just offering that as a possibility. But my point is that there's a tendency to shy away from things that scare us or intimidate us. Tonight we want to spend a few minutes talking about a book in the Bible that is like that. I want to spend some time talking about the book of Revelation. And you know, sometimes when we talk about the book of Revelation, there are people kind of throw their hands up and say, oh no, let's don't study Revelation, you know. And it's because we find it sometimes intimidating, we're afraid of it, and so we want to stay away from it. And that is a big mistake. The book of Revelation is an important message from God, and He wants us to understand it. And so for a few minutes tonight, what I'd like to do is talk about just five simple keys that'll help us in understanding this book. This is clearly not an in-depth study of Revelation. It's just sort of an overview, but especially it's something to take with us when we engage in a deeper study of the book of Revelation. If we'll remember five simple principles, it will really be helpful. I want to stop here just briefly to thank you all for being here. As Jared already mentioned, there's plenty of things to do. Our schedules are typically very busy, and on a weeknight, a beautiful weather weeknight like tonight, there's all kinds of things to do. You could be out working in the yard. You could be taking in a ball game. I'm sure there's plenty of ball games going on. There's all sorts of things you could be doing, but you've chosen to be here, and we appreciate you very much for doing that. Thanks for coming. As we study together, make sure we're handling aright the Word of God. If there's any question, if there's anything that maybe you don't understand, or maybe something you suspect might be in error, please bring that to my attention so we can clear that up. Thanks for being here tonight. Let's talk about five keys to understanding the book of Revelation. And if you're going to understand the book of Revelation, there are several things that you have to recognize. And that is, first of all, that this book was written to a specific audience of people. In any communication, it's necessary to know who is speaking and to whom they are speaking. That is essential. You're going to miss the whole point if you don't understand that from the get-go. Who's doing the talking here? And who are they talking to? Let me give you an example. At my house, my daughter Sarah now, the youngest of our four kids, is well grown. She has four kids of her own now. But when she was still at home, imagine me saying something like this. You get to your room, you clean up that mess up there, and you don't come out until everything is in its place. Now, if my daughter understood I was speaking to her, then that would be an acceptable message. However, if my wife heard me say that and thought I was speaking to her, oh, now maybe we got a problem because we haven't paid close attention who's speaking and to whom they are speaking. Well, that's true of all communications, and it's true here in the book of Revelation. But thankfully, we know to whom the book is addressed because the book tells us so. In Revelation chapter 1, verse 4, John, to the seven churches which are in Asia, grace be to you. And so this message was initially addressed to seven churches in a geographical area known as Asia. Sometimes when we are studying in the Bible, we'll refer to this region as Asia Minor. Today it would be the area of modern day, the modern day country of Turkey. These seven churches were all located in that area. In fact, we have more identification still in that first chapter at verse 11. What thou seest, write in a book and send it unto the seven churches which are in Asia, unto Ephesus and unto Smyrna and unto Pergamos and unto Thyatira, unto Sardis and unto Philadelphia and unto Laodicea. And so we know the recipients of this message. They were real Christians living in this general geographical area identified as Asia. This is not an imaginary thing. This wasn't written to imaginary people. This was written to real people in real places in that first century time frame. At the start of the book, it is identified for us. And even at the end of the book, in chapter 22, near the end of the book, chapter 22, verse 16, I, Jesus, have sent mine angel to testify unto thee these things in the churches. And so as you're studying the book of Revelation, pay close attention to that and try to, how could we say it? Try to put on your first century reading glasses. Try to imagine that you're a Christian in one of those churches in the first century. And as you read this book, how would you have taken it? What would it have meant to you? I think there's a really important principle here that any interpretation that is placed upon the book of Revelation that would have proved meaningless to those first century Christians, probably not the right interpretation. It was written to them. It was written for a specific purpose to them, as we'll be discussing. And so if you're trying to put an interpretation on the book of Revelation that wouldn't have made any sense to those people living back then, 2,000 years ago, you probably have got the wrong interpretation of the book. Do you remember? This, it's hard to imagine it's been this long ago, but do you remember the first Gulf War back in late 90 and early 91? Man, 30 years ago. Do you remember Saddam Hussein in Iraq had invaded the tiny country of Kuwait? And a number of countries were assembling forces together to drive him out of Kuwait, the first Gulf War. If you paid any attention to religious commentators in that time, they were all saying, oh man, this is the book of Revelation coming to fruition. This is the great battle of Armageddon about to take place. All the assembled forces of these nations are going to have this great battle. Revelation is surely unfolding right before our eyes. Well, fact of the matter is that first Gulf War was a fairly insignificant skirmish in the annals of historical warfare. It didn't last very long at all. It was over just about as soon as it started. It certainly wasn't the fulfillment of the book of Revelation. I always wonder what happens to those prognosticators when they are shown to be so obviously wrong. They never admit they were wrong. They just go on to predict the next thing. But if you would stop to think about it, a minor military skirmish in 1990 or 91, how could the book of Revelation have been about that at all? For one reason, it would have been meaningless to the people to whom the book was originally written. You see my point? So as we're studying the book of Revelation, remember the audience. Remember to whom the book was addressed. Secondly, remember the specific setting that those Christians were in. They were under unique circumstances. And the word, of course, the single word to describe what was going on in their life is persecution. They were under an intense persecution. And the book of Revelation was a message of hope to these suffering Christians. Notice chapter 2, verse 10. The Lord says to them, fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison that ye may be tried, and ye shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life. Notice that these Christians were in a tough circumstance. They were enduring a terrible persecution. And here in this verse, the suggestion is the Lord knew it, but he said it's bad and it will get worse before it gets better. Notice that they were going to have tribulation for 10 days. I don't think anybody imagines that that was 10 literal days. But the point of it is you're in this tribulation, but it's not going to last forever. In fact, it will be relatively short-lived, this time of tribulation. In chapter 6 at verse 9, John says, I saw under the altar the souls of them which were slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. How bad was this persecution they were suffering? Bad enough that some were being put to death for the cause of Christ, being martyred for the cause. In chapter 7, verse 14, these are they which came out of great tribulation and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Notice the word there, tribulation. These saints were suffering a great tribulation. That's the kind of terminology we see in the book of Revelation, denoting this enormous spiritual struggle that was going on at that time. And the point of it seems clear to be that God was aware. God knew what was going on in the lives of these Christians, and the Lord would make it right. And so you need to remember that as you're reading and diving deeper into the book of Revelation. It was written to this specific audience as they were dealing with this intense persecution. Let me suggest to you that it's extremely important to understand the specific timetable of the book of Revelation. I think if we were to go out on the streets of Cullman, Alabama tonight and ask people what they understood the book of Revelation to be about, I think probably the majority opinion, people would say, well, it was talking about things that would happen in the future. It was predicting future events. And that, of course, is a significant part of the book of Revelation. It was describing some things that were going to come to pass. Look at chapter 1, verse 19. In Revelation chapter 1, verse 19, John is instructed, write the things which thou hast seen, and the things which are, and the things which shall be hereafter. Write about the things which you have seen. Now, this would suggest that part of what would be mentioned was recent current events, or recently happened events, rather. And then notice, things which are, things that are going on right now, current events. So John was told to write about things that have recently happened, write about things that are happening right now, and then, of course, significantly, write about things which shall be hereafter. Now, that's the big question mark. What about these things that shall be hereafter? How far out in the future? How long before these things take place? If I were to write you a letter or send you an email and I just said, I'm coming to your house, your first question would be, when? I need to know when. And that's the question we have here. There were some, John was going to write about some things which shall be hereafter. When would that happen? How far out in the future would those things be? Well, again, thankfully, we are not left to guess about that. In chapter 1, verse 1, this is, and I think all of you who've studied Revelation before know this to be the very first verse to be a really important verse in the book of Revelation, if you're going to understand the book at all. Revelation chapter 1, verse 1, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him to show unto his servants, notice, things which must shortly come to pass. And he sent and signified it by his angel unto his servant John. Well, that's a major tip-off right there, right? So concerning the things that were going to happen in the future, when John was writing about the things that were going to happen in the future, they were going to happen in the near future, things which must shortly come to pass. That's what John was going to write about. In verse 3, same chapter, chapter 1, says, blessed is he that readeth, and they that hear the words of this prophecy, and keep those things which are written therein, for the time is at hand. Get that, right? We get that. That is not hard to understand. You know, a lot of people, oh, the book of Revelation is just so terribly hard to understand. I don't have any trouble understanding that, do you? The book is written about some things which must shortly come to pass. The book was written about things which were at hand. You don't have any trouble understanding that, do you? The book was not written about things way far off in the future. The book was not written about the first Gulf War in 1990 and 91. That'd be way off in the future. This was stuff that was going to happen soon. That's at the start of the book. At the end of the book, we have that verified to us. In chapter 22, verse 10, he said unto me, seal not the sayings of the prophecy of this book, for the time is at hand. And so at both the start and the end of the book, we are told in no uncertain terms, we are told that the future events under discussion would happen in the near term, not in the distant future. By the way, it's just an interesting comparison. If you study in the Old Testament book of Daniel, Daniel made some prophecy of future events, but he made prophecy about things that were centuries away. At the end of the book of Daniel, Daniel is told to seal these things up, for the time is not yet. But John, on the other hand, writing in the book of Revelation, was told, don't seal these things up, for the time is at hand. See the difference? And so again, in regards to the timing of events discussed in the book of Revelation, it's clear that the time was short rather than long. The majority of all that's mentioned in the book of Revelation has already come to pass. Now, I understand, and I believe, and I think most of you would probably agree with me, that in the last couple of chapters of the book, there are some references to the end of time and final judgment. That obviously has not happened yet. But in regards to most all that's mentioned in the book of Revelation, they were a description of things which must shortly come to pass. I don't think I have to advise you of this. I'm sure you're aware of this. And that is, as we're studying the book of Revelation, we see a specific style of writing being used. You really don't have to be a great Bible scholar to recognize that there's something different in the book of Revelation than most of the other books in our Bible. There are symbols and there are figures. Certain things are used to describe other things. There's a significance attached to numbers, and there's a significance attached to colors. All of that sort of thing, that symbolic figurative language, is used for emphasis. That's what figurative language is for. And we are told, again, in chapter 1, verse 1, to be on the lookout for symbolism, for figurative language. In chapter 1, verse 1, again, we read this a minute ago, but notice the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass. And he sent and signified it by his angel unto his servant John. He signified it. It was spoken in signs. It was figurative, symbolic language that was going to be used. And so as we're studying the book of Revelation, be on the lookout for that. Because if you're not, I think you will really get confused. You know, we use symbolic, figurative language a lot. I don't know if you've thought about this, but in normal daily conversation, we use symbolic language a lot. For instance, if I were to tell you, it rained at our house the other day, it rained cats and dogs at our house the other day. Would you think for a minute that I meant that cats and dogs literally fell out of the sky? You know better than that, right? Of course, that's just symbolic language used for emphasis to stress that, man, it really rained hard at our house the other day. Or how about this? Have you ever heard the expression lock, stock, and barrel? You know, he took that thing, lock, stock, and barrel. You know where that comes from? I had used that expression for years, and I didn't even know where it came from. That expression actually comes from gunsmithing. The lock of a gun is the hammer and trigger mechanism. The stock, you know what the stock is, the wooden part that you hold up against your shoulder when you're ready to shoot. Lock, stock, and barrel, you know what the barrel of a gun is. Lock, stock, and barrel, that's all there is to a gun. That's the totality of a thing. Well, we use that sort of figurative language to be descriptive, for emphasis. We always do that. What if, as we were coming into the assembly night, one of the young mothers said, oh, I'm so tired. The kids were like a pack of wild Indians today. Wild Indians? Really? And the mother says, yes, I'm not exaggerating. That is literal. I mean that literally. They were wild Indians today. But you get the point. We use figurative language for emphasis, to stress something. Now, here's a cautionary note. When figurative language is being employed, you got to be real careful, because if you try to assign a literal meaning to a figurative expression, you're going to miss it completely. You're going to get yourself all confused if you try. Now get that. You cannot apply a literal meaning to a figurative expression. That will always lead you to the wrong conclusion. Let me give you a couple of examples. Have you ever studied with Jehovah's Witnesses? I imagine that many of you have. The Jehovah's Witnesses, if you say nothing else about them, you have to say they're very evangelistic about their message. They're very aggressive to go door to door and try to engage people to discuss what they believe the Bible teaches. And so lots of us have had occasion to study with Jehovah's Witnesses. If you have, you almost certainly are aware of their peculiar doctrine that says that there are only going to be 144,000 people go to heaven. Only 144,000, not one more, not one less. Only 144,000 will go to heaven. Now the rest of the righteous, what's going to happen to the rest of the righteous is that God's going to refashion planet Earth. He's going to put it back in the condition that it was in when Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden. And the rest of the righteous will inhabit the earth, but only 144,000 will go to heaven. Now, where did they get that anyway? Where did they come up with that idea? Well, they got it in the book of Revelation, right? Let me show you a couple places where we read about that. It's the only place that I know of that the number is anywhere mentioned in the Bible. Look at chapter 7, Revelation chapter 7, verse 4. Revelation 7, 4. And I heard the number of them which were sealed, and there were sealed 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel. Of the tribe of Judah were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Reuben were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Gad were sealed 12,000. And on it goes. All right, 12,000 from the 12 tribes of Israel. Well, there's the number. And the Jehovah's Witnesses want to latch on to that 144,000 and say it's exact, it's literal. Next time you have a chance to study with a Jehovah's Witness about that, ask them this question. Do you believe that every one of the 144,000 persons will be a physical Jew? They will say no. They don't believe that. I know that because I've asked them. But that's how the 144,000 is described here, right? They're described as physical Jews. So here they have the dilemma. They want the number to be literal, but they want the description of the number to be figurative. You can't have it both ways. It's got to be one or the other, right? I think clearly the right answer is that it's figurative. 144,000, 12 times 12,000. Again, we said there's some significance attached to numbers in the book of Revelation. That would be a number denoting fullness, ultimate fullness. And so the number wasn't intended to be literal. It was figurative. The Jehovah's Witnesses got it wrong. Let me show you one other place quickly where they latch on to this number. Here's the only other place I know it's mentioned, also in the book of Revelation chapter 14. In Revelation chapter 14, verse 3. Revelation 14, 3 says, They sung as it were a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders, and no man could learn that song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth. These are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. And it continues. Again, here's a great question to ask the Jehovah's Witnesses about the 144,000. Do you believe, ask them this, do you believe that all of the 144,000 will be males and virgins, male virgins? Do you believe that about every one of the 144,000? They will say no. Again, I have experience on it because I've asked them. No, they don't believe that. Again, they want the number to be literal, but they want the description of the number to be figurative, and that just doesn't work, right? Again, they're making this mistake of trying to attach a literal meaning to a figurative expression. I simply think, again, that the number is significant in the sense that it denotes fullness of the saved. Have you talked to anybody, change the illustration, have you talked to any of your religious friends or neighbors who believe in the theory of premillennialism? My guess is that you have, because these days most all of our religious neighbors believe in the theory of premillennialism. Now, we don't have time to go into deep dive into premillennialism tonight. But the idea is that Jesus is coming back to the earth to set up a literal throne in the city of Jerusalem and to reign here on earth over a physical kingdom for 1,000 years. That's what the premillennialists believe. Well, where'd they get that idea of Jesus reigning for 1,000 years on earth? Well, again, the only place I know it's mentioned is in the book of Revelation. Look at chapter 20 real quickly. Revelation chapter 20. Verse 1, I saw an angel come down from heaven having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years, and cast him into the bottomless pit, and shut him up, and set a seal upon him, that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years should be fulfilled. After that he must be loosed a little season. And I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them. And I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus and for the word of God, and which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither had received his mark upon their foreheads or in their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. There's your 1,000 years in that text, Revelation 20, verses 1 through 4. Now, look at that. Again, we don't have time for a really thorough analysis of this text, but I just want to point out a couple of things. In verse 1, an angel has a key to a bottomless pit. Wait a minute. A bottomless pit? Could there literally be a bottomless pit? Could you dig a bottomless pit? No. You can dig a really, really deep hole. But I don't care how deep you dig it, there's going to be a bottom in it. You know, the very idea of a bottomless pit tells you this is not talking about literal things. Surely it's not talking about literal things. And it says that he had a key, and he laid hold on Satan and bound him with a great chain. Can you bind Satan with a literal chain? You can't, can you? Satan's a spirit being. He can't be bound with a literal chain. That's got to be figurative, right? The passage is, and my point is, the passage here is screaming out figurative, 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 symbolic, not literal. And that being the case, then why would we go to the 1,000 years and say that's literal? The 1,000 years is literal. Why? When the passage is clearly describing things in figurative terms. Quickly, here's a question. If you're studying with your friend who's a premillennialist, ask them this. Do you think that the people who will reign with Jesus during his millennial kingdom on earth, do you believe that they will be only martyrs, only people who were killed for the cause of Christ, but not just any martyrs, only martyrs who died by being beheaded? Because that's what verse 4 says, right? I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Christ. They lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. So only beheaded martyrs will be reigning with Christ during the millennial kingdom. Do you believe that? They will say no. They've got the same problem again, right? Trying to force a literal interpretation on a figurative passage, it never ever works. And so we just need to be advised of that. We need to be on the lookout ourselves when we're studying the book of Revelation. Be fully aware of this unique style of writing, this figurative, symbolic writing, and be careful not to try to force a literal interpretation. Finally, I'm hitting the wrong button. Let me hit the other button and go forward instead of backwards. Finally, let me suggest to you that the book has a very specific purpose. And the specific purpose, as we said earlier, this book was written to persecuted Christians. Many had been imprisoned. Some had been killed. And they were frightened. I would say a fair term to use is that they were terrified. It was written to give them comfort and assurance. I want to try to really test your imaginative skills for a minute. So I just want you to try to picture this now. This is going to be hard, but I want you to try to imagine this. Imagine that you get into bed tonight. It's a little late. You had some things to do when you got home from services, and you get all those chores accomplished at home, and you get in bed, and you just get into that real deep sleep. You know, you've just really gotten into that hard, deep sleep that comes quickly. And just about the time you get to sleep, like this, the phone rings. You know, it used to be that we had a phone on the stand by the bed. Now we've got our cell phones within arm's reach. But the phone rings. And you pick it up, and you pick up the phone, and you're really just still half asleep. Hello? Yeah, who is this? And the person on the other end doesn't identify themselves, but you recognize their voice. Although they are extremely agitated and excited, you recognize it's one of the other members of the congregation here at South Coleman. And that person says, "Did you hear? Did you hear what happened?" "No. What are you talking about? What happened? Did you hear about Jared? Did you hear about Jared McCrary?" "Well, what about Jared?" "Jared is in jail. The police came around and arrested him tonight. They said they're looking for all Christians, especially preachers, and they arrested Jared and they took him to jail." And then the line goes dead. Something happens and you're cut off. And you're still in a daze. You're just barely awake and you're still in a daze and you think, "Somebody pranking me here? Somebody pranking me on this?" And before you can get that sorted out in your mind, the phone rings again. It rings again and you answer, and now you're kind of gunshot. You answer, "Hello?" And it's a different member of the church here at South Coleman. "Did you hear what happened? Did you hear what happened?" "Yeah, I just heard about Jared." "Not Jared, Jim Deason." "Well, what about Jim Deason? What's wrong with Jim?" "Jim is dead." "What? Jim is dead? I just saw him a couple hours ago. How could he be dead?" "The police came to his house. They knew that he's a preacher, been a preacher for a long time and an elder in the local church. They just took him out by the side of the house and shot him with a firing squad. He's dead." Now, you can't imagine that, can you? I know you can't. I can't. It's not even imaginable. You can't even come close to imagining that. We have never, ever known anything like that our whole lives long. But that's exactly the kind of thing that was happening to these Christians. That's the kind of thing that they were enduring. If that sort of thing happened, you think you'd be scared? I know you would be. I would be too. We'd be terrified. And that's exactly what was going on with these first century Christians. That's the kind of horrible persecution and trauma that they were dealing with. And so again, this book was written to comfort and assure them. They needed to know that God is still in control and that ultimately God would be victorious. The book of Revelation shows Jesus on his throne. It shows the beasts destroyed. It shows Satan defeated. It shows martyred Christians alive around the throne of God. Victory. By the way, just as a side note, don't be too intimidated by that business of the beasts in the book of Revelation. The land beast, the sea beast. All we need to know about that is that they were agents being used by Satan to further this persecution against Christians. That's all. We don't need to know. We don't have to identify more than that. We might be able to do better, but that's enough. They were just agents of Satan. But they are destroyed and Satan himself is defeated. God and his people are victorious. A lot of people have said, if you want a two-word summary of the book of Revelation, it's just this simple. God wins. That's what the book of Revelation says. There's a great battle between the forces of good and evil going on in the world today, as it was 2,000 years ago. How's this all going to turn out anyway? God wins. That's how it turns out. In Revelation chapter 17, at verse 14, "These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful." That's how the story ends. That's what happens. God and his people are victorious. Well, someone might ask, finally, if that's what this book is about, and if it was, in fact, written to those Christians who lived 2,000 years ago and not written to us to describe things happening in our lifetime, then is there anything in this for us? Should we maybe just take our penknife and cut the book of Revelation out and throw it away? Because it was written to them, but not to us. Maybe we shouldn't even worry ourselves about understanding the message. That'd be a big mistake. And the fact of the matter is, yes, there's a great message in Revelation for us. One last passage. Look in chapter 14. Revelation chapter 14, verse 9 beginning. Revelation 14, 9. "The third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, 'If any man worship the beast and his image, and receive the mark in his forehead or in his hand.'" Now stop there for a minute. Mark of the beast. Oh, that's another great curiosity. Mark of the beast. Again, I think all we have to know about that, the beast was Satan's agent helping to persecute Christians, if you received the mark of the beast, it showed that you were on his side. In other words, you were lining up with the beast, the persecutors. And so if you received the mark of the beast in your forehead or your hand, what's going to happen? The same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascendeth up forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night, who worship the beast in his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name. Now stop there for a minute. How would you put that in just simplest terms? Here's how I would say it. If you are on the side of those who oppose God and his people, you're going to pay for that. That was true 2,000 years ago, and it's true today. If you're on the side of those who oppose God and who oppose his people, who torment and persecute his people, God will punish you for that. Do not imagine that you can escape his punishment if you're on that side of this great spiritual battle. Keep reading there at verse 12. Here's the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. And I heard a voice from heaven saying to me, write, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth. Yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, and their works do follow them. You be on God's side in this great spiritual battle, and he will reward you for doing so. That's the story of the book of Revelation. There's a lot more to it, obviously. As I said at the very beginning, this is not a deep discussion of the whole book of Revelation, but I really do think that before you ever begin a deep study of the book of Revelation, these five principles need to be kept in mind. And then as you approach the more detailed things in the book of Revelation, if you keep these things in mind, it becomes clearer in the end. Thanks for your good attention to what we've had to say. I hope it's helpful as we talk about a book that is sadly too often sort of scary, intimidating. You want to stay away from that because it's hard to understand. I think it's a great message from God, an important message from God, and I think it is understandable, and I hope we've said something that maybe helps you think that way a little bit more. We're going to sing a song of invitation. As we sing this song, we'll be asking you to think about your life and your relationship to God. Remember, you need to be on his side. You need to be on God's side. This great spiritual battle that is described in the book of Revelation is still going on today. Whose side are you on? Are you on God's side? In order to be on his side, of course, you must initially obey that simple gospel plan of salvation. Hear, believe, repent. Confess your faith in Jesus and be baptized for the remission of sins. If you're ready to do that, we'd be anxious to assist in your obedience. If you need more information, more study, say so. That can be easily arranged. This is the most important decision of life. If you're a Christian already, but you've fallen back and not faithful to your Lord, come back to him in repentance, confession, and prayer. If we can help in any way, let us know while we stand and sing.